at Boomer Living Senior Living Broadcast, we are proud to be a part of a group of extraordinary industry leaders who are working toward a stronger society and a better future for older adults. The life paths of the baby boomers have benefited from the advancements in health and technology. It is these advancements that will redefine how we think about aging. In times of economic stress and social challenges, we need older adults to provide fresh ideas and collaborative solutions. Our elders have so much to offer, not just wisdom, but the practical experience and skills that can enrich others in the workplace, educational, and social settings. To appreciate the potential and value of the aging population, we must shape a future that accommodates the needs and demands of the baby boomers, their parents, and grandparents. This future, to reflect the advances in public health, provides age-friendly homes and communities, enables and encourages lifelong learning, work, and entrepreneurship, and promotes purposeful engagement and volunteerism. This future will build a vibrant longevity economy to increase access and opportunity for current seniors and generations to come. It is a future that empowers a population seeking fulfillment, a population that's ready to engage. It's a future that elevates purpose as a new life course model, harnessing their talents and calling on them to contribute to the lives of younger people as educators, mentors, advisors, and coaches. We hope that you enjoy these conversations. We believe their ideas will expand perspectives and encourages more people to join our efforts. So please let us know your thoughts, and I invite you to be a part of the conversation. Today, my guest is Dr. Regina Kep. She is a board-certified clinical psychologist, a gerontologist, and also a former assistant professor, a staff psychologist at the Atlanta VA healthcare system. For more than a decade, she provided direct patient care and consultation on the geropsychiatry outpatient mental health team. So I'm eager to talk to her today about the caregiving's journey and the importance of understanding older family relationships. So Regina, thank you so much for joining me today in Boomer Living.
Thank you so much for having me. I really admire the work that you're doing with this podcast, so thank you.
Thank you. So I wanted to go through some high level of caregiving. What is the best way to study caregiving, and what are some of the important roles of a caregiver?
In terms of studying caregiving, that's really interesting, because what I hear from caregivers is, I actually didn't know I was a caregiver until kind of far along in the process. I know today we'll talk about the stages of caregiving, and you'll see what the caregiver's journey looks like. In the beginning, many caregivers, even though they are providing care, actually don't see themselves as a caregiver. In terms of receiving training for caregiving, it really can depend on the illness of the care recipient. I like to talk about caregiving in the context of relationships. There would be no caregiver without a care recipient there. And so the relationship is essential. Typically, care is not needed unless there's an illness. And different types of care is needed for different types of illnesses. So there's a different type of caregiving for dementia, for example, than for cancer. There's a different type of caregiving for somebody who's had a stroke than for somebody who has heart disease and has not had a stroke. And so there are different types of caregiving. And to really learn how to become a caregiver takes time and practice. It can help, though, if we'll talk about these stages, if you have a lot of clarity around the illness and what other caregivers experience with that particular illness in terms of caring for the illness. One of the challenges with educating caregivers is what I just mentioned, which is that many caregivers don't know that they're a caregiver, and so don't know to ask for help around the caregiving sort of dynamics.
Yeah. I'm right there with you. To be honest, I didn't know there was a profession called caregiving. Growing up, that's what we were taught to do, is take care of your parents, until you go through a phase in life where you're such at a loss, not knowing what that journey is going to be like upcoming years, and sometimes feeling very alone, feeling very strained on your health, on your mental and emotional,
and on your family, and sometimes even feeling ashamed. So I think it's so important to bring light that there's caregiver, caregiving across, and that we should give them a lot more credit. And many of us, in my opinion, are going to be on the receiving, the caregiver or the caregivee. So that's how life rolls.
Yeah, Rosalind Carter has a quote that kind of speaks to that, Han. The quote is something like, there are four types of people in the world: those who provide care, those who receive care, those who have received care, and those who will receive care. You're right on the money.
Yeah. If caregiving is so important, why aren't caregivers being compensated more?
Oh my God. And you know, and it's the reason that many older adults age in their home and can stay in their home is because of family caregivers and formal caregivers. So formal caregivers are paid poorly and family caregivers are not compensated well, and then are put in these impossible dilemmas of, do we liquidate all of our assets so that we can qualify for Medicaid because care is forbiddingly expensive, and all sorts of dilemmas that families are faced with, and then very little compensation, if at all. Mm-hmm. And not only financial compensation, but social recognition for the important role that they're playing in society, really, and in their loved ones' lives. And then that's like at a greater system level. And then the majority of caregivers are actually still working. So more than 60% of caregivers actually still work close to full time. And so then their employer actually might not even have an adequate family leave program to help family caregivers help an aging parent or help a person in their family who's sick. And so there are these greater societal issues and financial issues, and there are business issues. And sadly, these roles tend to fall to women who carry the child rearing responsibilities and compromise work for that. And then also have are sandwiched with aging parent responsibilities. And if the workplaces are not set up to acknowledge or facilitate an opportunity for employees to take on some of these responsibilities, it puts people in a really tight bind, having to make difficult choices.
I'm with you. I asked that question with some sarcasm behind my voice and a little bit of comical behind it. It's because I'm walking that journey. It's emotional, physical well-being strain on you and your family. But then somewhere along the way, you have to have a sense of humor, you know, as you adapt, as you accept what life will be, what life is like for the years to come. But I know that question, there's so many stakeholders. And I wanted to bring that question to put it out there in the open so that we're all recognizing that it is such an important role, but it's underappreciated.
Yeah. 150%, since we're gonna compensate for the appreciation that people aren't getting. We'll overcompensate a little bit. 150% agree with you.
Absolutely. Now, what do you do when caregiving becomes too much, especially for one child or even on one spouse? What is your thought? How do people deal with that?
Well, it is so important to broaden your circle of support. And so that could be formal caregiving, that could be informal caregiving, that could be asking friends and family for additional finances to hire formal caregivers, or time. Can you come in and help on these days? Or can you do the doctor's appointments? Can you help with meals? It's really advocating for more support for your loved one and yourself when you're overwhelmed. And at a certain point in a caregiver's journey, there will come a time that the needs outweigh what one person can do. And support is essential, additional support, because it's too much for one person, really.
Yeah, it is. So what do you think it is like to be a caregiver during the pandemic?
Oh, well, so caregivers during the pandemic, actually, the CDC did a study a few months after the pandemic started. And I think they surveyed adults in June and then put out their report in August of 2020. And in that study, they found that caregivers actually report the highest levels of depression, anxiety, substance use, and suicidal thoughts compared to other high-risk adult groups, like essential workers, healthcare workers, African American and Latinx folks. And so caregivers actually are carrying the weight of, I really see it in families. We're here talking about families, right? Caregivers and care recipients. There is a lot of concern about how the pandemic will affect the person that you're caring for. And so what happens oftentimes when we're in a caregiving role is we become the container for our distress and for our loved ones' distress or potential anxieties. And so the pandemic has added a lot of uncertainty on families living with illness. It's caused a lot of challenges for families living with dementia because adult day programs have closed, because some of the structures in place that would help families to live a consistent, structured life are gone. Maybe you're still working. Now you have a loved one with dementia who's restless in the house and you're trying to host a meeting. It's really chaotic for caregivers. And so caregivers are actually reporting higher rates of depression, anxiety, substance use, suicidal thoughts. And I think it's something like 30% compared to like close to 7% of non-caregiving adults. So rates are really high. And then this, I know you speak to a lot of older adults here. The general older adult not living with a dementia disorder, though, was also surveyed in the study. And older adults actually report the lowest rates of depression, anxiety, substance use, and suicidal thoughts, and high rates of resilience. I'll say, actually, caregivers are also highly resilient. Even studies that look at caregivers do show higher rates of depression and anxiety and stress and distress while caregiving, even without the pandemic. But actually, there is a myth out there that caregivers get sick and die before the people that they're caring for. Yeah. You might have heard that. So there's research that proves that wrong, that actually caregivers, even though there are higher rates of depression, anxiety, and stress and distress, caregivers are also remarkably resilient and are finding meaning and purpose in the role that they have. And it's not diminishing their length of life or causing more illnesses. That does happen in adults who are not caregivers, who have depression, anxiety, and distress, but not in caregivers. So that's kind of interesting phenomena that we see.
The act of caregiving is one of the most mentally and physically taxing jobs imaginable. So caregivers, in my opinion, are truly the backbone of society, and yet they receive very little support. So in your mind, what policies need to be changed to better support caregivers?
Wow. So this is a great question. Brené Brown interviewed Melinda Gates, and they were talking about the importance of policy change around family caregiving as well. Back to that point of compensating caregivers financially, creating better policies in workplaces to accommodate family caregivers. So if more people, I'm in my 40s, I had my kids in my 40s. So our parents, my husband's also closer to 50 than he is to 40 now. And so we have little kids, tiny kids, like a 3 and a 5-year-old, and aging parents. Our parents are much older, right, than in a sort of cohort before us who had children younger. And so now, because people are having kids later, there's also you're starting your family later, but then that means your parents are much older. And so you might be sandwiched more. Right. So that means you might be in the middle of your career and also have children, little kids, and aging parents that you need to help out. And this back to the workplace policies around accommodating family caregivers and creating more space for that. I think recently, there's been more in the news about the toll of the pandemic on women and the compromises women have had to make during the pandemic because of childcare and because of elder care. And so I have a good friend, MJ Grant, who cares for her mom with dementia, who's also deaf. And MJ is a sign language interpreter. So MJ has to move around her house because she has less access to formal caregivers for her mom. Also, because her mom is deaf, she needs a formal caregiver who can sign. And so then MJ has to do her Zoom meetings around the house in special places so her mom can see her because her mom can't hear her. Her mom is also losing vision in one eye, so her peripheral vision is off. So it's very complicated for them. But MJ has a 6-year-old and mom with dementia who's deaf from, you know, childhood. So MJ signs, the mom signs, and it's very complicated. But the COVID and the resources during COVID are doing her no favors, of course. So she's really had to manage no school for her child because that would create more risk for the mom because they all live in the same home. And so it's really complicated on women, especially. It's really pressed and squeezed women, especially.
I echo that. Yeah, there's so much that still needs to be done. And I'm glad that you and I are putting ourselves and the message out there so more folks can chime in and just underscore the importance of it. So thank you.
I will say that back to your point about caregivers being the backbone of society, I totally agree. And one of the challenges that we're highlighting too, there is a lot of recognition for parents. While there might not be enough support for parents, especially during COVID, there's recognition. You know, children are celebrated and there's hope and there's energy. And it's a different conversation than when we're talking about caring for aging parents with illness or caring for aging parents at the end of their life. There's less emotional support and energy around, tell us how things are going. There's more, it's easier to talk about, tell us how things are going parenting during the pandemic. People are less likely to ask a caregiver, tell us how things are going caring for your mom with dementia during the pandemic. It's a conversation that's not happening so readily. And so then caregivers are again being dismissed, disregarded, unheard, unseen, invisible. They call caregivers the invisible patient. It's again just reinforcing this idea that caregivers already experienced that I don't matter, that my role doesn't matter in society. So this, what you're saying, Han, about caregivers being the backbone and we need, and often we don't remember that we have our backbone. We don't see it. It's just there holding us up. And that's the same, unless it's injured, you don't know that it's there. You take it for granted. And the same is true. And so I like that expression that the caregivers are the backbone.
Yeah. On a personal level, you know, your loved ones may be even scrutinized if they're not doing a good enough job. If you're caring for, let's say, mom or dad, grandpa, grandmom, for whatever reason that your loved ones are not doing well, sometimes families may be scrutinizing the person that's caring, you know?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, and it's easier from the outside looking in to see all the things that need to change. I can tell my husband he hasn't done enough in the house, and then he'll remind me, actually, I did all these things, but I didn't see it. The same is true for caregivers. So if you're a caregiver who's a primary, so typically in families, there's a primary caregiver, and there might be ancillary caregivers, helpers. But if the helpers or other family members have a thought about how caregiving should be done or a fantasy about how caregiving should be done, and then compare it to how caregiving is actually being done in the pandemic with impossible decisions that you have to make, you know, it's not a fair interpretation of what's actually happening. That also causes a lot of distress. And if there's not family harmony around the caregiving situation, that causes a lot of stress and distress.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Okay, so now I want to dive into what you're passionate about, which is the caregiver's journey and the six stages that come with that. So can you walk us through those six stages?
Sure, yeah. As I mentioned earlier, caregiving happens in the context of a relationship. And so these stages are actually stages for the relationship and the caregiver in the context of that relationship. So it will include role changes and conflicts, internal conflicts that often come up that have to do with these role changes and the illness that you might be caring for as well. So the first stage in the caregiver's journey is called the pre-caregiving stage. And this is before your loved one needs any care, before there's like an illness that's pretty noticeable at all. But this is where, and I'm talking about adult caregiving and older adult caregiving. That's my area of expertise, is caregiving older adults who are nearing the end of their life or have a significant illness, like a life-altering illness, like a terminal cancer or a dementia disorder. And in this early caregiving stage, this is where there are just two mutual adults, the caregiver-to-be and the care recipient-to-be are just two mutual autonomous adults. And at this stage, you're just going about life. You've probably lived separately. If you're an adult child caring for an aging parent, you may have lived separately from your older loved one for decades. And really this stage here is really important for the journey, because what happens is the quality of our relationship before we start caregiving can sometimes create a roadmap for what caregiving might look like. So for example, if you lived in a family that had a really hard time managing conflict and was very private and secretive about medical or mental health needs in the family and didn't talk about things, you might not have all the information as you go along the caregiver's journey, right? If you grew up, if you have a family where there is a lot of deception and betrayal, you might not trust the information that you get. If you are in a family where there was a long period of estrangement or you were mistreated by your loved one who you'll be caring for, you might have a lot of resentments and anger, right, along the journey. And so understanding your relationship before you even start caregiving is why pre-caregiving is so important. How healthy are you in your relationship at baseline? And so the struggle here is what all families have, their dynamics. Are your family dynamics functional or dysfunctional? Are they healthy or not so healthy? And so the goal in this stage is to really make sure that you are as healthy as you can be, mentally, physically, emotionally, socially, in your own relationships. And if you anticipate that you might be a caregiver for somebody, that you also foster health in that relationship. And you can do that by just having discussions or building connections. And so that's the first stage, this pre-caregiving stage. And it's called the mutually autonomous stage, just two adults going about their life. And the second stage is called the early caregiving stage. And this is what I call the ambiguous caregiver. And this is what we talked about a few minutes ago, Han, where now I'm caregiving, now I'm not. Now I'm helping, now I'm not. You're in and out of this caregiving role. You're not fully clear. Is this an illness? What, especially with a dementia disorder, it can be really hard to understand if it's dementia early on. You just notice some behaviors and you wonder, is this normal? Is this not normal? And so you'll see a caregiver in this early caregiving stage, this ambiguous caregiving stage, just say, I'm not a caregiver. Am I? And so they don't know. There's a lot of confusion. There's a confusion about their role. Am I a caregiver? Am I not? Am I helping? How much do I help? Am I helping too much here? Should I back off? Uh-oh, if I back up too much, they're going to get hurt. Should we take away the keys? If we take away the keys, they're going to the car, they're going to be isolated. They live in a rural area and they're not going to be able to get around. If we let them keep driving, we worry there's going to be an accident. And so there's a lot of how much do we step in? How much do we back off?
Oh, I'm sorry. And I noticed as you're making the decisions for your loved ones, you have to be very mindful because not only is there safety at hand, but also the sibling dynamics. Yeah. You could easily get scrutinized if you make the wrong decision. And that's heavy because you want to keep that family dynamics unified. Right? Yeah. As much as possible.
Yeah.
Very difficult to do. I'm sorry.
Very, very difficult. In a second, I'll give you a metaphor for that. The back to that family harmony piece. It's so tough. In this stage, so there's a lot of confusion about the role. How much should I step in? How much should I back away? And a lot of confusion about the illness. Is this an illness? Is this normal? Is this an illness that can get corrected? Is this an illness that's going to get worse? And so this is where you might hear caregivers say, especially with like a dementia disorder, they might say, it's hard to know where the personality ends and the dementia begins. Or yesterday, she could do this all on her own, and today she needs my help. She's so manipulative. Or she could do it if she wanted to. She's just faking it today. And so there's a lot of confusion. And these are like typical. This is common. So if you're thinking these things, you're not a bad person. You're trying to make sense of this. Is this illness? Is this not? Am I a caregiver? Am I not? That's why it's ambiguous. And that's the struggle in this stage. So the goal in this stage is that you gain clarity about the illness and its trajectory, what it will look like going forward, and that you also gain clarity about your role and, to your point, that you work toward family harmony if you can. And so in the pre-caregiving stage where it looks at your family dynamics, how well are you all communicating? If your family dynamics are already at this where somebody in the family tends to be more scrutinizing or judgmental or harsh or critical, that might get amplified when there's a sick person in the family. If you can imagine a mobile that like hangs from the ceiling over, we put them over cribs to stimulate the baby. But there are some beautiful artistic mobiles that hang from artistic structures. And when somebody in the family, and that's like a representative of a family, even a dysfunctional family will find its balance hanging there. So when somebody's sick, it tips the balance. And then the family is off kilter. Even adult and older adult families can get off kilter when somebody is sick. Oh, I don't want to take on that caregiving responsibility. I don't have that kind of a relationship with my loved one. You do it. And so the balance gets tipped. And when the balance is tipped in families and for individuals living in the families, it's really chaotic and distressing. And families will fight to rebalance it. And so we actually put our old way of doing things. We try to put them into these caregiving stages, but it doesn't fit. So it's like putting a square in a circle hole. It doesn't fit anymore because the person is sick. It's not going to work. The way you communicated as a family is not going to work anymore because now the conversation has changed to something else. Though the dynamics, like a hypercritical sibling or hypercritical parent, or if you're self-critical, that might get magnified. And that's why health is so important all along this journey, but especially before you even start caregiving. Health for yourself and for your, if there's harmony in the family. So the third stage then, so we've done pre-caregiving, early caregiving, which is that ambiguous caregiver. The third stage is, yes, I'm a caregiver. There is no denying it. I have to be there. I'm a caregiver. That's it. And so in this stage, it's pretty clear that your loved one needs assistance and that their functioning has declined significantly. And so maybe they need help with toileting. Maybe they need help with bathing. Maybe they need help with other tasks. If they have a dementia disorder, maybe they need help with all tasks, activities of daily living and instrumental activities of daily, like all the tasks need assistance in this stage. And this is to your point, Han, early on, where you were asking, what about when people become really overwhelmed? Like the care needs are too high for one person. And that's really common in this stage. And that's where caregivers actually in this stage will start asking for help because they actually see, I am a caregiver, I need help here. And that's when you'll see caregivers actually start to look for resources because they understand that their role is caregiver and they need resources to help them with this. And so having some reinforcements, like I like to see think of this as a circle of support. So you have your loved one in the middle and then the circle of support around them. So it's not all on you. And then that circle around might be friends and family or professional caregivers. And then beyond with like adult day programs and other sorts of maybe the medical system and Alzheimer's Association or cancer societies, things like that. And in this stage, it's really important because overwhelm is so high, because the care needs can be so high. It's so important for caregivers to get help and broaden the circle of support, but also to attend to how meaningful the role that they are in is. And are they, the caregiver herself, actually valuing this role and the magnitude of what they're doing and the meaning that it's bringing to them and their family. And so to really take stock of how important this is, like Han, you were talking about this is the caregivers have an essential role. And it sounds like you are having your own experience, right, with this personally. And you know, without your support or assistance, things would fall apart. There would be no structure or backbone to hold the whole mobile up. It would crumble. And so it's so important for caregivers in this stage to reflect on how meaningful this role actually is and the magnitude of what you're doing. Of course, all along in all these stages, self-care is essential. That's a given. We have to be our healthiest selves because we need to be flexible and mindful and curious and receptive and perceptive. We have to be all the things, and it's hard to do that if we're not taking care of ourselves. So I'm giving lots and lots of information with the stages. Should I pause for a minute or keep going?
No, keep going. I think it's great. I think everyone needs to know the depth of the six steps or the six components. I think it's very important.
Okay. So yeah, so this middle stage, this is where if people out here are familiar with instrumental activities of daily living and activities of daily living, this third stage where you're in middle caregiving or you are indeed, I am a caregiver, the person pretty well needs like full care or full attention If it's dementia, they might need 24/7 care. If it's another sort of illness, they might need assistance. Maybe you have to use a handheld urinal because the fall risk is too great out of the bed. And you couldn't leave them alone for long because of falls or whatever it is. And so in this stage, I pretty well discussed this stage. So then we move into the fourth stage, which is moving toward end of life and moving toward death. And this is the stage I call the steward stage. And this is because you are the steward for your loved one's wishes. You're carrying the relationship. It's likely at this stage your loved one is not able to communicate with you so well, whatever the illness. It's likely that you are holding the light that will guide. I see the steward as a lighthouse storm. So your loved one is going through their transition and you have to be this confident, rooted structure, a steward, and you're carrying the weight of the relationship, the weight of the end of life wishes, you're communicating for your loved one, you're advocating. And this is really, while early on in the second stage, that ambiguous caregiving stage, it's very frenetic. There's like a lot of moving pieces and it's chaotic and you just need some order. And this stage, it, to me, in my mind, it's somber, it's quieter. And you and will have a different emotional, it's still emotionally intense, but a different emotional quality because you're grieving. There's an anticipatory grief happening. You see the end is coming. And you might reflect on your experiences as a caregiver in your time with your loved one and your loved one. And you might be communicating more with your family to let them know how things are going. Hospice might be involved. They might be asking you all the questions and not including your loved one anymore. And so this is the steward role here. And the goal in this stage is earlier on in the caregiving journey, the goal is to help optimize your loved one's life and not lose yourself in the process, right? You want to help your loved one live their healthiest life, even in the midst of illness, or their optimal life, even in the midst of illness, and do it with dignity and respect and not lose yourself. And then at this stage, though, you're working toward an optimal death. So it's like you've come full across the full spectrum of from life to death. And so you're really, the goal here is to work toward optimal, healthy end of life and healthy transition and death, which is very different from the beginning and very different emotionally for the primary caregiver. And so you'll be taking stock of your relationship, of your family relationships in a different kind of a way. So the goal is to prepare for a healthy end of life and an optimal end of life. The fifth stage is now, as the caregiver, you're grieving. It's the bereavement stage. And so your loved one has passed and you are grieving. Now, the complexity that can come in for primary caregivers here is that sometimes what happens, the primary caregiver might not be the executor of the will. There might be two different people. And so the family dynamic, back to that mobile, might, you know, tip the other way. And the primary caregiver might get a backseat to the executive planning or the will and estate planning, because you might not be assigned that person. And that can also, you can feel dethroned a little bit or less important when, like, for 10 years you've had the primary role and all of a sudden your seat has been taken away. And so that can cause a lot of internal conflict for the primary caregiver and a lot of conflict in the family. And so the goal here is to try to work toward family harmony and also your own bereavement process. Okay, are you ready for the sixth goal? Yeah. Okay, so the sixth goal is the final goal. So you're stuck with me. And the sixth goal is the rebuilding stage. And this is where you are no longer a caregiver and there is a vacancy now. Because if I were to ask you to create a pie chart of all of your roles in the second and third stages, you might have been a mother, a spouse, a caregiver, a business owner, all these things. And when you get to the very end, say you're a spouse and your partner dies. I worked with a woman who asked me, when do I take my wedding ring off? As the marker of this transition, right? And so when you get to the end, you might have pieces of your role map, like a pie, if you were to create a pie chart of all of your roles. She had caregiver and spouse gone. And so that was a lot of vacancy for her on her pie chart of what do I do now? I'm no longer a spouse. I'm no longer a caregiver. I might not be working anymore. Maybe I left my job to care full time for my loved one. And so I might have all this vacancy. So what now? And so it can be very lonely. One was that example of when do I take my wedding ring off? Another, a woman who had been caring for her loved one with dementia for 15 years was saying to me, it's so quiet at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. This is the time that I would go visit him. Mm-hmm. And so there's all this space. And so what do I do with this space? So there's a lot of grieving and rebuilding. And what the goal here is to rebuild with purpose. So what purposeful, meaningful things do you want in your life? What roles do you want in your life now? And that's the rebuilding and recovery stage. Yeah. And those are the six stages.
Wow. Wow. Gosh, thank you for that. And what is the name of the book that you have that covers the six stages?
Yeah, so this is based in a family systems therapy model. So there's a therapy called caregiving, a family therapy. And that it talks about the roles in these transitions. Okay. I think it was originally, this stage model was originally developed by Pfeiffer in 1999 as a family therapist. There's a psychologist, Sarah Qualls, who wrote the Caregiving Family Therapy book. And then I added my own names to some of these stages. There's another caregiver's journey, six stages model, I think from Denise Brown. That's different than this model. It's also interesting. She talks about stages a little bit differently than I do, but also pretty intriguing, actually.
Now, the links that you provide, I'll include that in the show notes, and that's referenced back to the six stages that you described just now. I want to make sure I have the right links when I put
this. Sure. Yeah, I've been doing family therapy for 20 years in a systems framework. One of the godfathers of family system psychotherapy's name is Mnuchin. And he talks a lot about these family structures and imbalances and role transitions and role changes. And that's part of what this model is based in, is in this family systems model. There's also a family medical model or medical therapy where you're adjusting to illness. There's also the biopsychosocial piece where you're adjusting to your own health and wellness from a psychological, physical, spiritual, and social perspective. That's really essential for self-care and other care. And so it incorporates these various theories in psychological theory and in psychotherapy.
Great. Great. Okay. So I'm going to ask you a couple of questions that's around mental health. So now what are some of the things that a person can do to maintain their mental health as they age? And also, are these things people should start doing at any age, whether you're 30s, 40s, or 50s, regardless of the age?
I totally agree. I'm glad you're asking because I'm a clinical psychologist. So I work with people around mental health all the time, and especially older adults. So my practice is with older adults. Exactly what you said. These recommendations will help at any age. So one is physical activity and exercise. And these are great for mental health and also for reducing risk for dementia. So these are important for both. And there are some neuroscientists that are looking now that something like 30% of dementia can be prevented by lifestyle changes. And also the way we think about aging also affects our development of something even like an Alzheimer's disease, even if we have the gene for Alzheimer's. Just the way we think about aging, if we have a positive view of aging and we internalize that and really believe that, it actually can shift our if we convert to having a dementia disorder and how quickly we develop dementia. So this is all really important. So what we can do, maintaining physical activity with your doctor's consent, but so some sort of physical activity that is approved by your doctor, especially if you're living with some medical conditions or limitations, healthy diet and proper nutrition. And what's really important are social relationships. So that is key. There was actually a nun study that looked at women nuns who were in a convent, and they looked at their brains after. And some of these women had pretty advanced stages of dementia, but it didn't show. They weren't as symptomatic. And the thought is because they were so socially engaged in the convent. They were so connected and united and had a role and a purpose in the convent. So having social interactions friends is incredibly important for our mental health. Older adults are actually great at that. So the people who actually have the highest rates of loneliness are 18 to 24 year olds. Older adults, while we are concerned, there is concern about social isolation and loneliness among older adults. The people at most risk are young adults. And that's older adults have really high resilience rates. So that's really important to know as well. But the other piece is also there is a lot of information and research now on mindfulness and aging and how important mindfulness and self-compassion are. And so I had a podcast where I talked about resilience and aging during the COVID pandemic. And what research has found is that actually older adults have higher rates of wisdom. And the feature of wisdom that older adults possess the most is compassion. And self-compassion has actually been key to resilience during the pandemic. So that's pretty remarkable. So older adults actually can teach us a lot about how to get through this pandemic.
Exactly. You know what you just said, older adults, and then all the benefits that comes with older adults. Why is there such a stereotype being older is so bad? You just described older adults have all these. And I agree with you 200%. And it's a shame that not enough folks in society perceive it that way. And it's still stereotyped to be, you know, frowned upon because they're anti-aging, right? They're so pro-Hollywood and just don't give enough regard to the older generation. So I'm with you.
And research is with us, Han. When we have a negative view of aging and when we reinforce negative views of aging, it increases rates of mental health conditions and increases rates of medical conditions, major medical conditions. There's something like it costs the U.S. every ageism, costs the U.S. every year, something like $63 billion. And that even shifting our view of age and aging and shifting it to more positive view can save us 1.7 million or billion. I can't remember exactly. I just did a presentation on this to 500 health providers within the VA system nationally last week. But it would save us. It would reduce the incidence of illness by 1.7 million or billion. I can't remember. In 1 year. I mean, it's actually ageism is a pandemic. And of course, COVID is a pandemic, and ageism and COVID are both disproportionately affecting older adults. And we can do something about ageism. We don't need a vaccine for that. We can shift like you're doing here, and we're giving more information, but we can shift the way we think about aging and the value we place on aging. Absolutely. And media and Hollywood have something to do with that too.
Enough about people talking about ageism. I think it's great to put it in the forefront, but I think it's more important that we be a part of that shift, like what you and I are doing right now. So I'm more geared towards taking action, educating, informing, putting it out there, and just take action and be a part of that shift. So I think it's very important. So would you say that external factors like society or community events or internal factors like your own attitude and a sense of life purpose, which has a bigger impact on mental health for older adults?
I don't know that I could tease apart which is more significant or which is more influential. They're both influential. So there are structural and societal ageism. And then there's what's called the stereotype embodiment theory, which is internalized ageism. Both contribute to mental health and aging and physical health. I need to say that again because we focus on mental health, which is, I'm a psychologist, that's my jam. But the other piece is that this affects physical health too. It affects rates of dementia. It affects cardiovascular disease. It affects mental health conditions. It affects cancer. It affects all sorts of physical health conditions and all sorts of mental health conditions. So barriers. One is that we have a misconception about what's common with aging. So because of messages we've been fed about aging, there's a common misconception that dementia is normal with aging when it's not. There's a common misconception that depression, at some point, don't we all become depressed? Everybody's dying around us. We're all going to move. Isn't this depressing? And then so we have this misconception that at some point we're going to be depressed. And also, we have these ideas about older adults that, well, old dogs can't learn new tricks. Older mm-hmm. adults will never change. So they're never going to go to mental health care. But here's the thing. With depression is highly treatable among older adults. So it's not normal with aging, but it's the most prevalent mental health condition. And it's highly responsive to treatment. And older adults benefit from treatment at the same level that younger adults benefit from treatment. And so if we believe it's normal, we're not going to advocate for our loved ones when we see some depressive signs. We're not going to advocate for them to get mental health care because we're going to think it's normal. Why would they need mental health care for that when it's not normal? And when older adults don't get mental health care that they need, their rates of illness go up. They use more medications. They have more ER visits. It takes longer to actually leave the hospital when they are medically hospitalized. And it increases the risk for suicide, which is higher among older white men over 85. It's the highest rate of suicide is among older white men. And so if we believe it's normal, we're not going to get our loved ones help. But we need to know depression is not normal with aging and is highly treatable for older adults and other mental health conditions as well.
I always think to myself, we have to be very mindful of what we do to the parents and grandparents and the aging population, folks turning 65 plus, 10,000 a day for the several decades. We have to be very mindful in how we spearhead in serving those older adults, because guess what? We're on our way to be there, and it sets the stage for how our children to care for us. So be very mindful. I keep always remind myself and remind my colleagues. I think it's very important.
You know, we're all aspiring to be older adults. None of us are saying, I want to die young. That's a tragedy. We all want to die after 100 years old. Like, we're all aspiring to be older adults.
Right. It's,
yes, to your point. The internalized stereotype. So the stereotype embodiment threat that I talked about, or theory. So this is when we hear stereotypes and we internalize them and we believe them. And so this, when older adults have negative beliefs about aging or believe negative stereotypes, their rates of depression are higher, their rates of suicidality are higher, anxiety is higher, and their belief around treatment is lower. Also, there's some research that shows that when we believe negative stereotypes about aging, when we are indeed older ourselves, we are less likely to engage in we'll have lower will to live, for example. We might be less likely to take our medications. It affects our behaviors in terms of how we're caring for ourselves as we age. Oh, I'm just a burden. We dismiss our contributions to the family or to the world when we have an illness and we're older, if we believe these negative ideas. And so that's the threat of internalizing this ageism. And that's how it plays out, that you would have higher rate of dementia or faster progression of dementia if you believe these negative things, or have more depression. I'm not going to take medication for depression because I'm not going to get better anyway because I'm old.
Right.
I mean, that's a negative belief around aging, and it's also not true. But if you believe it, that's going to affect how you respond to your own care. And so that's the threat and the risk of these ageist ideas and how it plays out in medical care and in mental health care.
Yeah. These are very good points, and I hope the listeners just take it on, own it, and make an impact on, let's say, their parents and grandparents, but you know, also for themselves, right? Because in my mind, aging is a gift. We're still breathing, we're living, and it is our choice how we want to live, but it's a gift. And along the way, you know, live to the fullest, be impactful, especially during this tragic time when you hear deaths from COVID. And I think one of the things that has taught me is you just gotta live beyond your fears, right? We're fearful of what's going on, how we're all impacted by this. For me, it just impacted me to recognize the unknown, the fears, but you have to live above it. So
yeah,
that's my take.
And persevere, yeah. And that you have something to offer. So the other, I think that the your point to moving through the fear and living well and optimally and enjoying your life is so important, because that leaves a legacy that teaches and reshapes the ageism that you are passing down to your lineage and your legacy. And it's so important that message is shifted, that older adults also shift that message. Older adults internalize this ageism. Younger adults internalize this ageism. There's actually some research that shows that, like, at age 30, if we have negative age stereotype beliefs, that we're more likely to have a cardiovascular event by age 60. It's remarkable, some of the research out there.
I thank you so much just making this time and connecting with me and sharing your passion. It sounds like you're doing some great work, and let's keep that conversation and that message alive for many years to come.
Yes, but the work that we are doing to share and shift the message around positive aging and healthy aging, hopeful aging, it's so important.
I got to tell you, everything that you're talking about, I wish I had 8 years ago. Right? Because it is a very lonely journey when you don't know about it.
The caregiver's journey?
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very lonely. Because like you say, most people didn't even know that they're playing the role of a caregiver.
That's right.
Because often it's a role of a daughter that you fulfill. It's an honor, it's a privilege, and it is something that you were raised to do. And my older siblings, I think, carry the weight heavier because they're older. I come from a big family, but still it's something that needs to be in the forefront, that you're on this journey ahead. And these are some resources that can help you. And I think mostly continue to embrace of that journey. And that's very hard to do. That's a big word.
Embracing,
but if you can come to the place where you can accept and adapt and embrace, what a blessing.
Oh, and to find a new type of connection with your loved one. I really am terrified when the time comes that I have to care for my mom. I have four brothers. I'm the only daughter. And actually, I'm not the closest with my mom. One of my brothers is much closer with her and would be a better caregiver to her than I would be. Or my mom and I have had a strained relationship over our life. And then I think, then there's a piece of me that thinks, wow, what if we find, and my mom and I have been working on our relationship, but there's a piece of me that thinks, like, what if we find, finally, get some, like, I have this hope in me that, like, at the end, what if we have enough grace for each other, enough compassion for each other, that we have a new kind of deep connection or loving connection that we weren't ever able to find before? Like, how beautiful and special. So, like, I'm terrified. And then equally, I'm thinking, like, gosh, I wonder if it would be rich and meaningful in a new kind of way that I don't even know about.
Yeah, it's the healing process. Sometimes time heals. I also think going through a difficult times perhaps helps the healing process, which I don't like. But I think life has shown me otherwise.
During COVID, I have a lot more respect for my mom than I did. My mom is a single mom of five kids.
Oh, wow.
And I'm a married mom of two little kids with many more resources than my mom had.
Yeah.
And I am like, I have so much more compassion and grace for her now. That's like maturity and life experience and just perspective as a parent. I have so much more, having been through it myself now, just respect and admiration for what, and my mom lived with a severe mental illness that I don't live with. And so just what she was able to do, I have so much more respect and admiration for.
Isn't that something that old saying? You don't understand, you don't appreciate until you become a parent. Isn't that the truth? I'm with you. I mean, I'm the youngest of 10 and my mom is in her 90s. Yeah, it's a lot of people. Talk about family dynamics and coming to...
Oh my God, the harmony.
Yeah, harmony / disharmony at
moments.
Yeah,
of course.
Oh, it's I don't even know where to begin. It's a blessing and it's a life journey. I'm at a loss because I totally don't know where to begin, because that's like a whole different topic.
Yeah.
But I know, we're talking about appreciation of your parents when you become a parent.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm right there. My mom and dad have 10. I have 3. Often I'm thinking, like, what are you complaining about?
Yeah.
Especially during the teenage years. And now they're older. My daughter's going to go to medical school. And then my son is a senior in college and I have a baby. Yeah, he's 18 years old, so I'm going to be a near empty nester.
You're about to launch.
Yeah, and it's a different place in life, and we're sorting out and trying to navigate how to strengthen that phase, because let's face it, we go through life, a big chunk of that has been very task-oriented, where we take care of the kids and their activities and their school and sports and college and... So I'm hoping there's a sense of relief. I'm hoping that I'll find my purpose.
Yeah, a lot of new beginnings for you and your family.
Well, I thank you for your time.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Han, and for the thoughtful questions. Well, thank you for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
You take care.
You too. Bye.
Thank you so much for joining us this week on Boomer Living Podcast. Make sure to visit our website, boomerliving.tv, where you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and other platforms. This way, you'll never miss a show. And while you're at it, if you found value in this show, we would really appreciate a rating in iTunes, or simply tell a friend about the show. That would help us tremendously. Be sure to tune in weekly for our next episode. And remember, growing old is the purest and the most positive experience of human existence.